was ambassador in Cairo in the 30s, late 30s. Late 30s.
And he was for a while the deputy of Cadogan in a special...
You understand? Yes.
And he was in charge of the Middle East. Cadogan didn't do this.
But he certainly been in Cairo.
And Peterson was the...
The enemy.
Yeah, he was. And then the
all the others too.
Well. Boris Baxter and others, I mean, minor figures. Minor figures. Now.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, what's the name that I remember a minute by him? Hanke.
Yes.
Was he in the Eastern Department?
He was, at a certain period he was.
Because I tell you the story.
He was not
but, no, I know. But you know the story about Nachum Goldman and Weizmann and me at Partition, I tell you. Look, since we're talking about Partition, and relevance is not important in this series. When Nachum came to see me, he told me about Partition. I then proceeded to write a minute about Nachum's visit, in which I was not very respectful about Nachum, I wasn't hostile. But I said, you know, in his usual bustling manner, usual costume, that's something. I was glad not to have it published. William Frankel managed to suppress it in the Jewish Chronicle, because they saw it in the end, in the papers. Because William Hayter read a minute. But I read a minute to Hayter, who was the next man who we saw, who was another, who was not a tall anti-Zionist. Hayter then. Hayter a little more. And so I said, so then I reported, and I put in my telegram even, or dispatch something, I am told that there is this partition scheme. And then when I said that Nachum told me I might have done, could have done Niram Vayet. And now I found in the public record office, a minute by Hanke, saying this is terrible. Mr. Berlin's telegram, paragraph 4, reports of the things which we tell Weizmann in confidence. That he gossips about this to his friends in Washington. This may get to the Arabs, in which case we'll be done for. That's all I mean. No, it's all right. There's nothing improper about that. There are two Yankees. Might even be three. There is a young Yankee who just retired, who was private secretary to Heath about 10 years ago.
Now, the one we are speaking about is Robin Hanke. And
was ambassador in Bucharest.
I think that's the one.
That's the elder brother. The younger brother just retired.
Robin Hanke's minors are decent.
He was, they are very decent. Both the brothers are decent. Both the brothers. My father had dealings with him in Bucharest. When timber was wanted, he was sent by the government to Bucharest, and it was no good, it failed. But he dealt with Hanke, he said, was a very nice man.
Now, as we came to, by chance, to the Washington case, whom did you really appreciate there in the embassy?
First of all, there was Halifax, who behaved like a viceroy. Didn't care for the officials. He worked, of course, they went to see him. But he behaved like a viceroy. He was an Etonian viceroy, and they were all Wickhamist pen pushers. He looked on as a collection of clerks. They couldn't bear him for that reason. He was very grand and aloof. I was occasionally asked for lunch, and when they were not, because he'd known me in all sorts. That was very bad, too. And I respected him. He was very clever and very quick and very idle. He didn't really like Americans very much, but he found that when he switched on his charm, they fell for it. And see, in the end, he did rather like them in the way in which he was very considerable. Very great. Very great. I knew him well before and after. Oh, he was delightful storyteller. He was very nice voice, and he told stories in an ironical, charming, and very sort of crazy way. He is. He's very unpompous.
Now, his political acumen
was very considerable.
Did he like the report?
Which might have been. Well, you hardly read them. But I did get into trouble with him once. About them. I mean, already, it was done by the Chancery. Done by, first of all, where there is the Chancery. The first head of Chancery was Hoyer Miller. After it became ambassador somewhere.
Yeah.
Bonn. And head of the Foreign Office. I remember very well when Gurion came and wanted to see Halifax. He said, we wouldn't have seen him in the residency in Cairo. Why should we see him here? He was a very bureaucratic, still alive, Lord Inchara, he's called. He just passed my telegrams. Occasionally, he would say, your fourth paragraph will cost the British government £74 in cipher charges. Is it worth it?
Who would
tell you? Miller. In effect, didn't read them at all.
Why didn't you read them?
Because he was idle. He probably did, but I mean, very casually and quickly. No, I will tell you. Sometimes he put things in, telegrams. They were not all mine. He said, I saw Harry Hopkins last night. That was on me. And other people did too. I wasn't. My drafts were altered or rude.
I saw the introduction to me.
Which is, well, I exaggerate a bit. The introduction.
That's why I'm asking.
And that's why I kept out the Israeli cables, the Zionist cables, too, for that reason. It is another character way. Anyway, now, there were a great many people in the embassy. There were something like 3,000 British officials in Washington during the war, to the ministry. But the embassy was not so big. The embassy probably had about 200. One day was a minister, was a man called Ronald Campbell. There were two ministers called Ronald Campbell. He was called Little Ronnie. Big Ronnie was ambassador in Portugal. He was an absolutely delightful man. Charming. Conventional. He believed what he believed. But personally, couldn't have been nicer. To me particularly. I liked him very much. He was civilized, he was amusing. He was agreeable, great friend of Mrs. Roosevelt in the 30s, long before he was president, in the 20s, when he served in the embassy. And sweet Scotch diplomat, not very clever, very careful, not very brave, but kind and amiable. Under him was head of Translate, Hoyer Miller was simply a bureaucrat, managing director, remembered every file by heart. Very boring. Another nice wife, Dutch, who I knew. Then, of course, there was John Foster, who got my job fundamentally in the embassy, who was very amusing and very gay. And he's a long story. Yes. He's a chapter unto himself. I could talk to you about him separately, Rouge. He played a part of my life. With him I went to Palestine in 1934. Then there was Michael Wright, who succeeded Hoyer Miller, with whom my relations were never easy. My Zionism was known. He was one innocent and didn't like Jews, particularly. Was fundamentally humorless, hardworking, fanatical, and man of some principle. Anti-appeasement, hated Chamberlain, hated Halifax.
I mean, he was the head of the Chancery?
Yes. Worked very hard, but was always tense. Always tense. Always on the qui-vive. With conversation with him was never easy. I once asked him why the English liked the Arabs so much. Because we have the same sense of humor, he said. The typical British remark, which has no truth in it whatever. None. Besides which, the Arabs anyhow couldn't stand them, as it happens. An Arab servant in his house in Washington. Typical Arab servant in Washington. His wife is American. I never really got on with him. He was very polite and very correct with me and tried to keep me in the Foreign Office. Even that, although he knew perfectly well what my sympathies were. And he really denounced the Jews in Israel to me. He said, they're bad neighbors. If they're good neighbors, something would happen. They're just bad neighbors. They're bad with the Arabs. They hate them. They persecute them. You can't be bad neighbors in a territory like that. That's what we more or less that was his case. I'm sure he tried not to be anti-Semitic, but of course, but he was served in many Arab countries. And obviously loved them. Quite rich. And of course, we all know what he did in the Foreign Office afterwards. But, as I say, he never circulated papers through the Middle East to me. I didn't need them, but I mean, I saw the general run of telegrams, as you know from a secret story which I was doing. But if something came up, even in Zionism, I'm sure he didn't send to me because he knew what I would say. But in every other respect, was totally correct, rather admired my work, and at the end of the war, offered me a job in the Foreign Office. Wasn't clear what. Maybe a librarian, maybe in diplomatic service. Wasn't quite clear what. Probably not diplomatic service immediately. When I said I didn't want to, when I go back to Oxford, he said, I cannot understand you. If you can enter public service, how can you refuse? He looked on me as a Zionist Englishman. He didn't look on me as an agent, really. No. That I can't pretend. Then, that's where they... Hayter was the first secretary. He was very nice. Civilized, amiable, not anti-Zionist. We may be friends with him. Definite friends. Him and his wife. He was a cultivated, New College workmanist. I felt at home. I taught a great many people like that during the 30s. Then, I remember talking. Then there was a man called Summerscale, who was from Baghdad. He was a commercial counselor, married to an American from Baghdad. She was in the American embassy. And he was a straight 100% pro-Arab. He loved economic affairs. In his house, I met Arabs. Arabs were, and he was very nice to me. And I used to argue with his house. And I didn't convince him exactly, but he thought I was the only Jew he'd ever spoken to who made a case which he could accept. And therefore, was very friendly. His wife, who was pure American, was very pro-Arab also. And then his son, I think, I saw in England sometimes. He went on living in Amsterdam afterwards. I occasionally saw him. He was a decent pro-Arab Englishman. Totally anti-Israel and anti-Zionist. But somehow, not vicious. Not nasty. He didn't come from upper-class prejudice. He was lower-middle class. Like all these consuls. Who else in the embassy I come across. Go Booth, after he became head of the Foreign Office. He was a Christian scientist. Immensely earnest.
Immensely?
Earnest. Very humorous. Honorable, hardworking. He created work on a fantastic scale. Every time you had a conversation with an American, he wrote it down and circulated it. He was a friend of various senators of a kind of democratic kind. Utterly decent man. With an Australian wife, we married in Japan. She was a nurse. I saw 2 days ago. 2 days ago. But he was, became, didn't think he was ever transferred in my time. Then there was John Russell. Was agreeable, gay, smart, upper class sort of Foreign Office boy, who went to Moscow and knew Russian. And to my mother could ever talk about that. He hated Gobooth. Gobooth was moralistic, humorless, earnest, high-minded. Russell was amusing, cynical, very good company. And people said about him that if Churchill came to Washington, he arranged everything, whether people where he stayed, other people stayed, got 50 rooms out of a hotel. Nobody ever gave anybody else, but British prisoners of war remained at the bottom of his file. He afterwards became, he went to Poland, and then he went to Spain as ambassador. He married Miss Europe, who was Greek, who was still about. But he was a friend. And with him I used to see the whole Russia-interested group of people in Washington. There was a man called John Wiley, whose wife was a Polish Jewess. There was Chip Bolin, who I met otherwise too, but who was a friend of Russell. There was a man called Freddie Reinhardt, who was a State Department official. There was a man called Durbrow, who was a State Department official. And who else? George Kennan, of course. He might have been in Moscow in 45. And knew afterwards. He wasn't part of all that. But the State Department, part of the Soviet, part of the State Department, became, I was part of that. I became an honorary member of that group. The line about me was, there was the only man they'd ever met who had never been in the Soviet Union, but who understood everything, as they did, the same point of view. My anti-communism, my knowledge of Russia, exactly what they wanted. I didn't do business with them because I had no executive post, but I learned a lot from them. And sometimes they used to make me report things to London, which I very much like doing.
You like it?
Why not, certainly. So the real so inside stuff. Then we're in the embassy again. We go back to the embassy.
Now, whom did you, have arguments with colleagues about your reports and dispatches, either before?
Yes. Yes, occasionally. Not very often. Never about the correctness. But if I put in a paragraph, somebody like Noel Hall, who dealt with economics, afterwards became principal of Brezhnev's, would say, look, I'm trying to deal with Atchison on this particular thing. If you report that, it'll queer my pitch. Nothing, that kind of thing. You ask me to take it out, because it would be awkward for him. The trouble about Noel Hall was, he told terrible lies. That's why he was got rid of at the embassy. He was a minister. But he reported imaginary conversations to make himself more important. In the end, this was uncovered. He had to leave. It was a kind of tiny scandal, internal kind. Now, nobody ever questioned, nobody ever said this isn't true. No, no. No, he didn't take it, because he used to spoil his policies. He complained that my reports went against things he wanted to want to believe. But even he never complained, formally. I never got the slightest riposte from the Foreign Office.
And you say never from Halifax, but...
Once.
You said once.
Quite interesting, quite serious. Ledwin Drebb arrived in Washington in 1944. And he wanted, it was something to do with post-war planning. Oh, I forgot to tell you about Crossman. I must just finish the anecdote. He came to Washington while I was in hospital, and he went to see Donovan. And he said to Donovan, I know you want us to get out of India.
I know
you want us to get out of India. If we do, will you give us French North Africa?
If we do...
Will you give us French North Africa? Donovan was very taken aback. He began making inquiries. As soon as he came to London, he made people in the embassy. Don't say, is there really a plan? Get out of India? Is there a plan with which the British occupy North Africa? Of course not. Pure invention. Crossman did it typically. Suddenly had an idea. Idea tried in London. Donovan couldn't conceive the British official would talk to him without any authority. Svara. Svara Tova. Now let's get back to Halifax. Ledwin Drebb asked me to write a dispatch about Walter Lippmann.
Yes, he has
given. What is it called? Prosperity.
But if you are fired...
I'm getting a little tired. I had 3 hours of talk before. Otherwise I wouldn't have been. I'll tell you a story.
This story and
the... No, certainly. Well, I read the dispatch. I saw Walter Lippmann once a fortnight. And we used to do Tour d'Horizon. We'd start Japan. We'd gone to China. We'd gone to Central Asia. Maybe India. World Siam. India, Russia, Turkey. Then, by leap, military, Palestine could not be mentioned to him. Could not be mentioned.
Why?
Because he was complex about being a Jew. And because Felix Frankfurter probably bullied him about it. They weren't friends by the time. Well, they were originally. 1912, so, because I mean, the last thing he wanted, but he wasn't favorable anyway. He was a man who hated being a Jew, did not enjoy it, couldn't deny it. Arthur Kroc, who was a famous journalist, was a Jew and denied it, except everybody knew. Walter didn't deny it, but was embarrassed and hurt by it in a way. No, the last thing he wanted to talk about. Painful and embarrassing subject. He was fundamentally a rather peace-loving, shy, not very brave, middle of the road, both ways looking man. He was a Republican, theoretically by then, because Roosevelt detested him. Now, when I wrote my dispatch was as follows. I said, Mr. Walter Lippmann is the most admired journalist in America. Everybody reads him, and he's more widely syndicated than any other commentator, and country editors, when they don't have enough of their own to say, look at his file, his dispatches, dilute them with water, and write themselves, like famous sermons in the 18th century, clergymen used to keep collections for their own use. I said that at the same time, as I said, he's temperate, he's moderate, sensible, wise, some ways, liberal-minded, his good judgment, in a way, but he has peculiar, not very fancy peculiar, he has a habit of changing his mind. Somewhat dramatically, is it? His first book was called, first book about the war, was called American Foreign Policy, Shield of the Republic. Fundamental isolationist. America had no business in Europe. Pacific, maybe. Tried. In Europe, they must keep out. They mustn't overextend their resources. They couldn't take on everybody. And Europe was too troubled. I knew you would think that because he was very pro-Munich and pro-Chamberlain. And that he was. I once met him at lunch with Kenneth Clark, who Chamberlain was supposed to come to. First time I met Lippmann. Chamberlain was late because of a cabinet meeting, went back early because he had to go back and didn't talk to Lippmann. Lippmann was in a state of fury, so far as he was capable of it, especially flew over from Paris to meet him. Anyway, second book, published about 2 years later, was called The Atlantic Community. The thesis of that book was that both sides of the Atlantic had to mesh together. America, Brazil, Argentina, England, France, Dakar, Portugal, they had interchangeable weapons, trade freight, they formed a single unit and they had a interdependence, economically and in other ways. Now that was also a very good idea, but not compatible with the first idea. The third thing was a series of articles about Stalin and Churchill, which he said that obviously Stalin and Churchill couldn't get on. They were obviously enemies. America would mediate Roosevelt. That was also an excellent idea, not compatible with A or B. So I said, fundamentally, it was not dependable politically. Quite a decent man, I think. But he had this habit of abrupt change of his mind. And was not too courageous. Halifax sent for me. He said, look, we show Walter some of our papers. We think he's a great friend. Hello, she said he was. You go and denigrate him to London. What will they think in London? They won't know what to think. We can't do it. Well, I stood up. Like Luther, I said, I'm very sorry, sir. I don't think I can change my dispatch. But if you ask Mr. Corbus, he'll write dispatch in quite a different sense. So you could use it. But I can't do anything about mine. Then he thought he went a bit too far. So he said, wonderful thing. He said, I consider the duty of a British official abroad is to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to the people at home. Any deviation or attempt to slant the truth in such a way as to meet with our wishes or one's own, I would regard as the gravest dereliction of public duty. They bowed, and they were then not really happy, he said, but it is all a matter of emphasis. If ever I wrote an essay about him, I would call it a matter of emphasis. You can't deny it, but with emphasis you can do anything. My dispatch was censored, but sent off. Printed in Nicholas' book. That was the only time I read the collision.
Now, so you see that he read this?
That he read. Dispatch. That wasn't telegram. That was sent by post and by bag. That was submitted to him. Well, he knew Walter Lippmann. Knew me well.
I mean, maybe the Benedict the Chancery knew what to show him. I mean, what would be of interest to him?
They didn't go to Chancery. That, I think, was for Gladwin Jam, who told him I was doing it.
Why is it connected with Gladwin Jam?
Entirely, I told you. It was commissioned by him. He came to Washington and asked me for a piece which he could show the cabinet and anybody else about Walter Lippmann, an essay.
Why? Because
then you just had no idea. I had no idea, just because I was interested, because somebody asked if he, what his views were, I don't know. His motive I didn't ask. But as I was supposed to be the expert on Americans, I was asked to do it. I don't know why. I never asked why. Not my business, say. What are you going to do with it? Who are you showing it to? Let's stop.
Yes, yes, sure.
Okay.